Okay, hi everybody. Steve Savitsky. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today I have Anita Tucker, who many of you probably remember from the whole story of Gush Katif. She was one of the spokespeople who was on TV and radio and media for so long, and really a wonderful, incredible woman. It's a great honor for us to have her on the program. Anita, how are you doing today?
Thank you. We're doing okay. We're trying our best to do okay.
Well, that's all you could hope
definitely,
for.
Definitely a challenge. But I'm no longer a farmer. I was a farmer for 30 years. I lived in Gush Katif for 30 years in the first town of Gush Katif, Netzach Hazani. I was one of the first people that came to Gush Katif when it was total sand dunes, and lived there for 30 years. Worked our farm. We built up a serious agricultural business. And no longer doing that, but thank God we managed to build a new town.
Right. So we're going to talk about that a little. We're going to talk about that a little bit, and we're going to talk about what happened. So first of all, I mean, I guess I don't want to get into the politics of it because that's really not the purpose of the program right now. But really, is to kind of talk a little bit about the people and what happened to them after they were forcibly evacuated from Gush Katif. And I think people maybe have forgotten some of the stories, but maybe you could just enlighten some of the people who are going to listen as to what really happened to some of the people afterwards.
Well, one of the most difficult things is that really, in actuality, there was absolutely no plan for what was going to happen to the people. So actually, we left with a little backpack or a suitcase or whatever it is that you took out with you, and we were let off at a corner outside of Gush Katif, and everybody was supposed to go their merry way. And we had decided that since when you don't have a home, you go to pray for your everlasting home. And we went to the Kotel, and we spent Thursday night there at the Kotel. And by Friday morning, we really had no idea where we were going to spend Shabbat. But Effie Etam, one of the members of the Knesset at the time, had arranged for us to go up to the Golan. So our entire community went up to the Golan for Shabbat to Chisvin, to the guest house in Chisvin.
Oh, sure, right.
And by Saturday night, we were thrown out of the guest house because they had other guests coming. It was summer, it was August, and they were filled with guests. And they moved us into the yeshiva dormitory that was sort of neglected, left after the boys had left the yeshiva there. And our younger generation, our young couples and the youth, decided that the Golan was not the place for us to be, because soon they would be going back to school, and they had to be somewhere in the south. And they decided to set up a tent city in Tel Aviv near the train station, trying to put pressure on the government at the time to find some kind of a solution, meanwhile, for us to live further down south where the children would be going to school. And it was very interesting, the setup in Tel Aviv. They had put up tents, and the little children, and they were all down there. The older people, like myself, stayed up in the Golan. And they made the first time that they really ever had contact with the people in Tel Aviv. And it was really very interesting. The people from Tel Aviv brought the people from our community food and blankets, and we had nothing. And, it was a very, very strange situation where people who were generous donators and givers in Gush Katif, there were every single chesed organization in Israel came to get vegetables from our greenhouses. Every day there would be trucks coming, and we would give a huge portion of our vegetables to tzedakah. And here we were on the other side of the plate, not having what to eat and not having, it was like a really weird situation.
So you never know what's going to happen. I think also probably for some of the people in Tel Aviv, they probably, were kind of supportive of the move. And yet, once they got to meet you and meet all the people, I guess they developed a totally different relationship and changed their perspective, right?
Absolutely. Because when you see a person, you understand that, justice is not throwing somebody out of their home. So if you want to, even today, even in the Samaria area, where sometimes the high court decides that they're going to take families out of their house because the land perhaps belonged to someone else, sometimes justice can't be done by throwing somebody out of their home. And, you don't always realize it. You think, well, the court decided this is the right thing to do. And it's so difficult sometimes to absorb that, you know, children and are being left with nothing, without a home, without a school, without a food, without, and this is basically what happened. And the people in Tel Aviv were very, very surprised, and some of them became very, very close with us. And with some of them, we're even still in contact to this day.
Really?
So really interesting things happened. Anyway, from eventually, there were arrangements made for us to go down to Kibbutz Ein Tzurim, for the south. And we lived in the guest house there for a while. My husband and I had my husband was teaching in Dimona, and he tried to go back to work. We had this little room that was really tiny. When our grandchildren came over to visit us, they had to sleep sort of under the bed in a sleeping bag because there wasn't enough room for much else. And we had a big house in Gush Katif, and we had two married children living in Gush Katif with grandchildren that were born there. And anyhow, we soon after, my husband felt that he just couldn't continue working. He felt a certain trauma and the traveling. So he went on early retirement. And then soon after that, we had a wedding of a son that we had written on the invitation that the wedding will take place in Gush Katif. And if we have to leave, then it will be in Ein Tzurim. So we had made two arrangements for the wedding, one in Gush Katif and arrangements also in Kibbutz Ein Tzurim, and it ended up that we ended up going there, and that's where the wedding was.
Why do you think, Anita, let me ask you this question. Why do you think,
yes.
I mean, the smart people live in Israel, government, whether you agree with them or disagree, but they obviously knew, regardless of what was going to happen in the Sharon government, they knew that they had to do something with the people. And so why was there a plan that didn't work, or was there just no plan?
Prime Minister Sharon at the time had insisted that they set up 250 homes in the Nitzan town for, it was like an example town in the Nitzan area, that there were 250 caravillas set up for 1,700 families. And when we had, through negotiators, undercover, through lawyers, we had sent them to Omri Shamron, Prime Minister Sharon's son, to discuss all of Gush Katif moving to this area. And he said to this lawyer, we want to spread them out in every direction. Why would we want to do that? And, you know, it's hard to believe sometimes, but maybe this is what happened. I don't really know. I just know what the negotiators told us. And what happened was that there really was no plan. They figured that everyone would go their merry way. The communities would not want to stay together. They didn't understand the concept of a community, of values, of spirit. And you can destroy a house, you can destroy a red tile roof, but you can't destroy a community that easily, and you can't destroy values and spirit that are based on Torah. And this is basically what happened. We knew that we had to stay together. We had three families in our community that were terror victim families, that their dear ones had been murdered in Gush Katif in those last difficult 5 years. We decided we were staying somehow together as a community, and we were sure that within a year or 2 years we would get land, we'd be able to acquire land again, and we would soon start our farms again, and everything would, you know, somehow work itself out as best we could under the situation. But to build a new town is a difficult thing, and a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of sometimes not goodwill, sometimes goodwill, but it didn't happen that easily. And as you can see, it took 9 years for us to build our town, and there's still only about 65-70% of the people in Gush Katif are actually in their new homes. And a lot of us say it, we're in our new home until we can build our home again in Nachalat Shevet Yehuda, in the area belonging to the tribe of Judah. Where we hope someday that there'll be an opportunity for us to live there again.
So let me just get this straight. So today, 10 years later, over 40% of the people from Gush Katif still have not really been resettled.
Right, approximately between 30 and 40%. Sometimes it's individual families with problems, but there's also entire towns that are not yet built up. The town of Katif, that through the government had arranged for them to move to build a new area near in the Lachish area, where the government had plans for building towns for many years, in Amatya. And there were many, many different problems of land, of approvals, of finding archaeology under the ground, and therefore they couldn't build in that spot. They had moved to another spot. And just now they finished doing the infrastructure, and just the whole process is just beginning that we actually started in our town about 7 years ago. So, you know, I assume that they have another 5 years to go until they're really going to be settled in their town.
And so what are they doing? What are those people doing now? Where are they living?
They're living in temporary caravillas that are falling apart. Mm-hmm. But it's a strong community. They've stuck together. They have many second-generation children that are also moved into caravans there and hope to build, have acquired lots there. They have to buy the lots. And, of course, the property value goes up as a place that is wilderness suddenly becomes populated with other communities like the Nida Kalim, the one from the Veda Kalim, and Netta, where there are people from Father Rome and other towns. In these different places, they've become very beautiful communities with a lot of, culture and education, and the property value goes up. And so these young people are having to buy lots at a very expensive price that their compensation from 10 years ago is not really relevant anymore. And so they're just having to try to take big mortgages and a very, very difficult process. So these families are really still struggling in this stretch.
Are there still, like, people in the Knesset who are pushing and helping, or is the government helping?
Absolutely. There are people in this last government. We don't know exactly what's going to happen yet now, but in the last government, there were Uri Ariel of the Ministry of Housing really put a lot of effort in trying to help us, and there were several other members of Knesset that tried to push things to move ahead as much as they could. But, it's not so easy. I remember very shortly after we were expelled from Gush Katif, I spoke at Tel Aviv University, and there was some professor of urban development who got up and spoke, and he said, "You guys are dreaming. Don't you know that it takes 10 years to build a new town?" And I thought the guy was crazy because, you know, what's the big deal? What do you got to do? You go and put down stones and blocks and, you know, put down a floor and you got a house. And we didn't realize, the bureaucracy involved and the approvals that you need and the building, different approvals that you need, environmental approvals and everything that you can think of. And it was a very long process. And sometimes along the way, there were people that were helpful. And sometimes along the way, there were people that made life very, very difficult and didn't cooperate. So each one with his different outlook on things. It wasn't an easy process. And if you think about it, that the process was being done essentially by people that were suffering from post-trauma stress is not so easy. There were, you had leadership in every community. You had leadership, but you also had many people that were really, really having difficult times. They were having difficult times financially, emotionally. Their self-image was damaged. If they were farmers and they no longer had a farm, there were many, many, many problems. And even today in my community that is built up and beautiful, and thank God we built a synagogue, in every building there's a feeling of tikkun, that wow, this is some siyata deshmaya. There's help from God here, because how do these people ever have the energy and the strength to want to build again? It's amazing. Every time I get up in the morning and I look out, I say, wow, this is totally amazing. Thank you, God, for helping us to find the strength to do it. But there were many people that really did not have the strength, and it was very, very difficult for them. And today, we have a second generation that have known something that's known, that it's called 9 years post-trauma. I didn't know about it before, but now I know about it. After 9 years, these young kids that were 15 at the time of the expulsion from Gush Katif, today are married with children, have bought lots, have a huge mortgage, are working, and they're having a real hard time progressing in life. And now they're starting to go to psychologists for treatment to treat this post-trauma syndrome. So who would think 10 years later, what are you talking about? Forget it. This is old stuff. Right. Let's forget it. But, we are quietly trying to deal with it. And trying, on the one hand, you want to move ahead, and on the other hand, you're still dealing with many things of the past. And on the other hand, you also don't want to forget. It's something that was important. It was a beautiful area with farming, and that was developed out of sand dunes. And we have to figure out how to keep it alive at the same time.
So now the community you live in now has the same name as the community you had in Gush, right?
Right. Right. That was a big debate, whether we should change the name, because if you remember in Gush Etzion, the one town that went back was Kfar Etzion, that never called any of these B'nai. There were many towns that were named by people that came from Gush Etzion and lived in new towns, but they didn't call it the same name. But the people in our town, we had three people, had dear ones that were murdered, and they, for them it was very important that at least the name keep on, and we did keep the name, and we really tried to keep the spirit and the values, and we're really trying to educate our children to again become givers and doers, and not just people that have to take chesed, because it's a hard thing to come out of, you know, when you become a chesed person, it's very hard to turn the plate back around again, and we're really, as a community, working very hard to re-educate ourselves to be involved in chesed in the area. And we recently, you know, went down to one of the vet places where they wrap vegetable packages for needy people, and we had the whole community down there wrapping the packages. And during the Tsuketan, the recent, you know, war in the summer, we were really involved in, you know, getting together packages, and our youth went down to the Gaza border, which we were all very familiar with, to meet up with the soldiers and, you know, bring the things and really trying to be involved in giving. And of course, many of the people here, of the older people who are farmers, are not working and struggling to manage. So we don't have huge people that can pay taxes, proper taxes. And that's also a problem to keep a community running in a situation that's so unusual. So it's another thing we're trying to deal with. How do you, you know, you can build a beautiful synagogue and a beautiful community center, and a lot of communities in the States are also dealing with it. But how do you keep that
how do you keep it going financially? Did they ever build a museum or anything?
Yes. I'm on the board of the directors of there are two museums in Gush that commemorate Gush Katif. One of them is in Nitzan, and it's called the Gush Katif Memorial Center, a commemoration center, and it's a government establishment that's sort of like the Begin Center that commemorates what the, you know, Lehi did and all those organizations. So this commemorates Gush Katif, and it has a government budget that commemorates, but it's along the lines of the government's thoughts, more or less. But it's a beautiful place, and it's a very meaningful place to try to show what Gush Katif was, and why something like that should never be done to anyone again, what the results of that was. And then there's another museum called the Gush Katif Museum in Jerusalem, which is a very significant museum. And actually, they're having this Sunday night the establishment of the Board of Trustees of the museum, because they're going to expand it now. They had a very generous donation from the Moskowitz family, and they're going to expand it into a bigger museum. And there's a different trend of thought there, really showing what happens when a person has to make a decision of what is right and wrong in his eyes, and how it was so difficult for the soldiers to make the decision, and sometimes they get carried away with their decision. And you see many of the very difficult movies. There's a room that's called the Black Room, and in that room they show the movies that are very difficult to watch, of policemen and soldiers beating young kids. But it happened, you know. It's not pleasant to look at, and it's not pleasant to see, and it's not pleasant to remember, but it happened. And you know, each time, each person in his life makes many decisions of what's right and wrong, and it's not always easy to make those decisions. What's your red line, and the moral red line in many different situations? And no one can tell someone else what his moral red line will be or should be, but there are things that happen in your life, and this is what happened to many of soldiers and the police, and even to our children and ourselves.
We all remember. We all remember. Yeah. We all remember what happened. I remember one thing, though. I remember that reading, and I remember seeing that time when you had the Beis HaKfaros. And what happened to the Beis HaKfaros in
Gush? Well, there were 48. There were 48 graves in Gush Katif, and many of them were moved to Har HaZeitim, to the Mount of Olives. Today, the place is not so easy to get to the Beis HaKfaros. There were some of them were terror victims. Some of them were people that were reinterred from different countries, parents of people from France who brought their parents over and reinterred them in the Gush Katif cemetery. There were two soldiers who were killed in Lebanon that were interred in the Gush Katif cemetery. My husband had a brother who was retarded, and he was in a group home in Cleveland. And he, when his brother died, his parents had already passed away. He had him buried in Gush Katif 2 years before the disengagement. And his body was taken out, and his yahrzeit was on Yom Yerushalayim, on Jerusalem mm-hmm. Day. And so we said, wow, you know, if we're going to bury him in Haaretz 18, how are we going to ever get there on Jerusalem Day? Because the traffic is impossible in Jerusalem right. on Jerusalem Day. And we buried him in the new cemetery that they put up in Nitzan. And it was a very difficult time because no one knew exactly when they were going to be taking the bodies out and how they were going to get there and where you were going to sit Shiva, because at the time we were up in the Golan in the guest house right. and we had to come down to Nitzan, and you didn't know exactly when. And then we got a phone call from the rabbinate that was dealing with it, the army rabbinate, and they called and they said, we're taking your brother's grave out now. Your brother's grave out now. And you know, the sand is collapsing, and the bones are starting to mix together. We're taking them all out right now. They thought they were going to be taking them out in stages, and they realized that they couldn't. And the whole thing was a very, very, very difficult process. And at the end, since we were up north, we had no place to sit. And I said, we brought along a low chair in the cemetery, and my husband sat the shiva there till the end of the day at the cemetery. And people that came around to be menachem him. Comfort him. And, you know, it was a very, very difficult situation. One of my good friends, somebody from Far Rockaway, actually, Brian and Sammy Hilberg, they had a son that was killed in with the 13 soldiers in Lebanon. He was in the SEAL Marines unit, and he was buried in Gush Katif. And Brian always says, I had to go around with a shopping basket to figure out where to shop to bury my son, because I don't know where I'm going to be living, and I want to reinter him near where I'm going to be living. But she had no idea where she was going to be living, and so she also buried her son in Nitzan. And of course, she's not living. We're living somewhere else now. But on this week, on this when the Memorial Day comes up, we're going to go to Nitzan, to the cemetery, and her, you know, she usually speaks at Memorial Day, memory of her son and the terror victims that are also buried there.
Well, unbelievable. You know, as I said, you know, that's why we decided to do something now to kind of remember, because it was such a terrible tragedy, and the tragedy continues, unfortunately. Well, look, you've been an incredible spokesperson for Gush Katif and for everything that happened, and you represented the Jewish people incredibly well in all the years that that you were asked to be a spokesperson. And we really sincerely appreciate your coming on the program and enlightening all the listeners as to really where we are today, 10 years later, and to still hear that there are 40% of the people who are still not settled. It's really an incredible thing. It's really unbelievable. But, Anita, just keep going. Chazak, you're incredible.
Thank you. And I invite your readers and your listeners to come to see
One of the missions we'll take, we'll definitely go there. Thank you so much, Anita.
Wonderful.
Have a wonderful day.
Bye-bye. Okay. Thank you.